And thank you, Brad and Desi. This is Betsy Rosenberg, your host of the Green Front Radio Show, and I'm pleased to have my occasional co-host joining me today. Of course, I'm speaking about my favorite climate convert, my favorite Republican, all the one and the same, D.R. Tucker is here, and he's going to help me interview someone who I have been very eager to get on the show, and that is one of the lead researchers on a study that came out a couple of weeks ago about the connection between media coverage and public opinion on climate change. If you listen to the show, you know this is my obsession. Yes, there is a connection, they found out. Doesn't surprise me. So why don't we have more mainstream media coverage of the biggest challenge of our time? Well, we're going to talk about that with Dr. Craig Jenkins. And in the second half of the hour, we're going to be talking about how do we get to net zero? What is net zero anyway in terms of getting our buildings to have a smaller ecological footprint? And that, of course, does have some impact on climate change and greenhouse gases. So that's a little peek into today's show. And without further delay, I want to welcome D.R. Tucker back to the Green Front, as well as Dr. Jenkins, who is professor of sociology at Ohio State University. Thanks for joining me, both of you.
Yes, how are you doing?
Hi.
Hi. So I know you guys have been busy since this research came out. Give us a recap of the major in your work that I think covered media coverage for about a seven-year period, I believe.
You're talking to me, Craig Jenkins?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes, yes.
Actually, it was about 11 years, really. We went back to 2001. The real message that comes out of this research is that there are significant fluctuations in public opinion, or the public mood, I guess you could say, and this does change over time in terms of the configuration of public opinion. But the bottom line that we found is that the big driver, aside from the state of the economy, is what politicians do. Which leads us to the contention that most of the divisiveness and the like that we find in public mood or public opinion distributions are really driven by what politicians do and how they're divided.
As well as media coverage?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The media do matter, especially the public media. Scientific media directly don't a lot. Nobody too much outside of the scientific community actually read the, you know, Science and Nature and the like. But yes, the popular science magazines and media coverage do matter. They're secondary, actually, relative to the politicians, but they are there. It does matter.
And, of course, we are seeing some extreme opinions expressed by politicians, especially those who would be president, and the media that covers them. And, of course, talking about Fox News and the like, 95% of talk radio being conservative. Are you showing, were you able to see not only that media coverage and what politicians say affects climate change, but in what way it affects opinion, either to raise more concern or to decrease concern?
Well, it works both ways, because what we were studying was perceived threat of climate change. Do people see that climate change constitutes a threat or not? And I don't know about, well, varying upon when you pick your time, 30% up to as much as 55% of the populace over that 11 years said it constitutes a threat. The trickiness to that is that there's always about 30% or so to up to near a half, and right now around 65% who say it doesn't constitute a threat. So then the question becomes, well, what drives that? And the biggest thing was what politicians are saying. We weren't able to, or didn't really, investigate the specific direction in which the public opinion moved relative to back or forth, other than to just see how many people thought there really was a threat. So we're not looking at the content of how, what kind of a threat it exists, and you know, whether they think it's human induced and the like. But we're assuming if they perceive it as a threat, they think it's something we ought to do about it. And I mean, the big surprise, in a sense, in our study really was the importance of what political leaders, meaning Congress, and the Republican Party actually say, what kind of roll call votes and what kind of messages they transmit, and that matters quite a bit.
Pierre, any comment on what your fellow Republicans, the candidates anyway, are saying about climate change and how you think that might be impacting American opinion?
I do think it has a tremendous impact and a negative one, sadly, currently. Dr. Jenkins, what was your research surrounding the 2008 presidential campaign? Because you had both Obama and McCain say that they accepted the legitimacy of the science. And in fact, both Obama and McCain seem to be for various forms of cap and trade that sort of level off the public's rejection or skepticism about the accuracy of the science.
No, I don't. Yeah, the question about how much the public sees the science, I really don't think that's the critical issue, actually. I think the fly in the ointment, if you want to put it that way, in science communication is that the scientific community doesn't understand that they're in a political war.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think they understand
that now?
No,
I don't think so. Michael Mann recently had this book that came out. I think he understands it. I don't think that the scientific community at large really understands that or the rules of engagement. It's a totally different game from dealing with your colleagues and peer-reviewed journals.
I think Dr. Catherine Hayhoe understands, since her chapter on climate change was cut by Newt Gingrich, that there's some politics going on, since he, of course, is the one who wanted her to write that chapter not so long ago for his book.
I think the thing that scientists, to that audience I'm speaking here, don't always comprehend is that they're in a values war, if you like, and there's no way out of that. You have to deal with the values that are associated with the implicit or at least associated loosely with the science.
Now, why do you think that is? Why do you think there's not a full understanding of that? Because when you mention that some scientists don't fully understand it, I think of Dr. Jim Hansen and how he's been attacked for nearly 25 years for the things he's been saying. You would figure that, you know, since Hansen's been such a target for this long of a period, you know, climatologists would understand that that their research is going to have them in the political crosshairs the same way Dr. Hansen's research has saw him in the political crosshairs.
Yeah, Dr. Hansen's a rare bird, though.
Rare and yet...
Unfortunately.
And his presence is so important, and his boldness in speaking out is so important. I was just talking to someone who was in my home last night for a green tea party, yet does not believe climate change is a problem, and I was surprised to hear that. And then I thought, if I could say one thing to her to perhaps open up her mind, what would it be? And I said, NASA's top climate scientist. You know, these are not tree huggers. This is not, you know, the usual suspects she would dismiss because of her politics and her ideology. And I told her to go Google Dr. James Hansen and see what he says about climate change and how we're very close to a tipping point. And she agreed to do that, and look forward to hearing her, you know, opinion. That's very credible right there.
Yeah, that's true. And there are figures like that who have been on the, so to speak, the front line and do understand the public communication side of science knowledge. But I think ultimately the average climate scientist who's better adept at this than the average scientist in the other fields they're not trained in it formally. They don't necessarily peer reward each other for it. There are people who have been leaders in this area, and I think it's important that they're able to do what they're doing, but I think that they need more support and more recognition of what they're doing. I mean, if you go back to the norms that guide now I'm speaking of the scientific or academic scientific community, is that there's a tendency among core academicians to poo-poo so-called public intellectual functions and to not give it the due and credit. And I think that creates a weak translation, so to speak, of the relevance of science, and it also creates some of the political games that we've seen in this climate area for the last, really for the last 20 years, but especially intensively for the last decade.
I just want to make an observation, Dr. Jenkins, when you mentioned the, you know, how some climate scientists aren't always, you know, sure about their ability to communicate the science and the accuracy of the science. I think back to Dr. Carl Sagan and how before he died, he was very, very outspoken about about the risks of climate change. Do you think that if he were still around, he'd be able to, you know, combat some of this denialist stuff? I can imagine if he were still alive today, he'd be going on Fox News and going toe-to-toe with Sean Hannity on this. But do you think his passing is sort of like one of the factors in this level of skepticism in the public?
Well, it certainly didn't help. That was after, and this is more relevant for the scientific community, is that Carl Sagan wasn't regarded highly by many atmospheric scientists. For better or worse, I think it was a stupid, short-sighted comprehension.
Well, speaking of stupid and short-sighted, what's your personal opinion? You can take off your researcher hat for just a moment about the fact that all of the Republican candidates for the highest, you know, office in the land say they don't believe in climate change. And do you think that they actually do? I mean, at least Newt Gingrich and Mitt Romney understand that it is a real threat. They're just being politically expedient. And how outrageous is it that we are having this planetary emergency? Every day is critical, according to the climate scientists, and we have, half the politicians running for, the Republican side of the presidential election, saying not only, quietly, but arrogantly, that this is a hoax. How outrageous is that?
Oh, I think it's pretty outrageous. I understand where they're coming for, whether it's cynical electoral calculations or values that they truly hold or some mix of the above, in some ways doesn't matter a lot.
Mm-hmm. I just wondered if that angered you at all, because
mistake. Yeah, it is a profound mistake, and the longer it goes, it will be a bigger and bigger and bigger mistake potentially in the near future. I mean, who knows exactly how long we have, so to speak, to get something to address the issue, but when you begin dealing with the issue, it will take decades to actually deal with the issue.
And actually said so much at stake, and you heard mistake, but of course it is a huge mistake, because science and facts, and not to mention the weather, are going to pretty soon, because things are happening much more rapidly than even the scientists predicted, make it obvious they're on the wrong side of the issue.
An interesting observation. I deal with military intelligence people in the climate area, and they understand well and take as a given that the science is, climate science is right. They're building security things to deal with the shrinking of the Arctic ice sheets right now. I mean, they've been doing it for several years now. So,
and that's adaptation, and I've got a great cartoon here. I love climate change humor, because we spend enough time being in angst and upset about it, so if we can laugh, great. There's a melting glacier, and it's a little boat there with the rooftops of some few buildings on the horizon, and it says, "Melting ice sheets lift all boats." Funny enough. My point is,
The U.S. Navy is going to be prepared for it, because they've been working on building the stations, et cetera, that they need for the Northwest Passage melt.
And the other cartoon I have here on my desk, so I can make myself smile, is a picture of Newt Gingrich saying, "I see a day when I'm sworn in as president." And the next box, he says, "I see a day when people will want to live on the moon." This was right after he declared we need to develop, moon development. And he said, "I'm guessing it's the same day." The day when I'm sworn as president and the day when people want to leave for the moon.
Okay.
Gotta laugh.
Okay, well, I don't know.
Colonize the moon. That was the word I was looking for. Colonize the moon.
It's going to be a crowded spaceship.
Isn't that just the height of hypocrisy and ridiculousness when you're saying, I do not, recognize this crisis on planet Earth. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about colonizing the moon, just in case I'm wrong.
Yeah. The oddity about this whole thing about the heat up right now that's occurred is that it to some degree reflects a peculiar situation where we have only political activity on the Republican side about this, really, in terms of public media and attention. And my suspicion, although we certainly didn't analyze it, my suspicion is that it's helping to drive down the percentage of the population that understands the climate change threat.
What a tragedy. Dr. Jenkins, what is your take on the Forecast the Facts campaign? This is a new organization of climate activists who are trying to push back against some of the climate denial that's engaged in by some meteorologists around the country. What's your take on that, and do you think meteorologists can be an important factor in helping to reverse climate skepticism in the public?
I don't know the particular campaign you're talking about, but I don't think there's any doubt that meteorologists are actually part of the population that you need to get out and make them involved.
And going back to your research, is it accurate to say that your study can now say that Al Gore was not a polarizing factor based on what you saw happening in year to year, like the public opinion study showing that Al Gore did not polarize the climate debate? Is that accurate? That was Joe Rahm's characterization of
your research
on the progress.
I think that's accurate in this sense, that it became polarized more after 2006-07. And that the downtrend that we witnessed in our data from 07, which was the sort of peak of climate change as a threat, public opinion, that Gore's contribution was to help, so to speak, lift that public opinion, and since then we've seen more of this polarization dynamic. The polarization, though, has to some degree been around for a long time. I think to some degree it wasn't as visible, and it certainly wasn't as central in political candidates and politicians' talk. And so in that sense, the polarization is new, and it's post-inconvenient truth.
And given that polarization, and given the, the omnipresence with 95% of all talk radio being conservative, and the noise and loudness of Fox News, faux news, pardon me. Do you think that there should be something in mainstream media that is telling the scientific truth on a regular basis, because these shows are on day in, day out?
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. That's part of what I was talking about when I said we don't really have a good public face to the climate science. And what I mean by that is that for the most part, there are genuine scientists, climate scientists out there who are skeptical still, but I think for the most part it's pretty clear where the mainstream of climate science is on this question of the longer-term threats. And there are obviously different scenarios about how the threat might work out over a longer 50-100-year period, but I think everybody agrees we're probably moving towards some kind of threshold processes. Certainly, given the time that it takes to implement things, we are. Because remember, that implementing significant changes in human energy consumption and the like, that's a multi-decade process. It's not something that happens quickly, and you can't just suddenly respond to it and see a change within a matter of a few years. This is a multi-decade type of dynamic. And to go back to the public media side of it, there really isn't too much other voice out there, certainly not right now. Some, but it's not it's not nearly as amplified as the current discussion we're seeing this spring in the Republican primaries.
The echo chamber, as we call it. We need an echo chamber that talks about the ecological truth, and is just as loud, if not as pervasive, as all the right-wing hoopla. And you make a good point that this is a decades-long effort. This will probably be more than decades, and I think some people use that fact as an excuse to sort of not worry about it now, put it off.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, given that we're already feeling the impacts, given how long CO2 is up there in the atmosphere, greenhouse gases, that it takes 50 years, it's like a response time to even go away and diminish. Given that, and given the urgency, wouldn't you say that we should use those same statistics, given the huge task ahead, to get busy yesterday and not to put it off?
Yeah, right. I agree completely. I mean, it's not something that's going to be dealt with easily or cost-free. And the long-term question, I mean, somebody tried to sell me on the idea that you should look at climate change futures like an insurance policy, and there's some, it's not a totally irrelevant analogy, I think it's limited, but you could think of it in a purely financial sense as, don't you want to take out this insurance policy in case things work out all that badly for the next generation or even sooner?
Right. So to those who say, we cannot afford to do this, it's the economy. Of course, Nicholas Stern's work and many other economists look at what will happen if we don't address climate change. And if we continue business as usual, which we're pretty much doing right now, it seems, the costs are going to be that much greater, not to mention the fact that government will have to intervene, which is what the libertarians hate so much about the possibility of acknowledging climate change. This is DR's theory, and I think it's right that for those people to grasp that there is such a huge threat, so there must be a role for government, is just more than they can take in.
And as the late Senator Gaylord Nelson said, the economy is a wholly owned subsidiary of the environment, not the other way around.
Yep. I remember reading a speech by Teddy Roosevelt, of all people, back in about 1912, something like that, where he said basically that wealth should be at the behest of the public.
Could you imagine if he said that today? He'd be stoned.
I don't know whether he would sound like a legitimate voice in most any political forum we hear routinely in the media, but yeah, in some places. But that statement is sort of striking because of it endorses a certain kind of what at that time was called progressivism. There's another sales pitch, so to speak, that is not often talked about and evoked. But, you know, energy efficiency pays in the short run, too, meaning, you know, within the next year or two. And the United States as a whole doesn't really deal seriously with energy efficiency.
And that's the subject of the next segment, in fact, how do we get to net zero? I'm going to be talking with a green building expert, so I'm glad you brought that up. And the fact that, you know, conservation, you know, is the best way to move forward in the short term. And yet, you know, without shows talking about how Americans can conserve, without the government really making this a priority, without institutions really making it a priority, you know, we're not even going after the low-hanging fruit yet.
Yeah, you talk to your building specialist, and I don't know whether he'll come up with this, but I was looking at energy efficiency statistics for Germany. Germany has basically had their household heating, cooling energy costs in the last decade, roughly, and therefore they're the only ones as a Kyoto signature that even come close to meeting the original Kyoto targets. They didn't meet them, but they got kind of close, and they did it largely because they were trying to do conservation. I'm not sure that they were really trying to pursue climate change. I don't know. I can't judge that, but your household energy specialist can talk to you about that in more detail.
Yes, I will ask her about that. Anne Edminster is her name, and she'll be coming up in just a couple of minutes. And you mentioned the Germans. They've been way ahead of us environmentally for a long time, first with the Green Dot, you know, product responsibility initiatives, and then now with solar panels, which they're certainly making, I think, as many as China, way ahead of us, and I hope installing as many. And they're also, I think, moving away from nuclear after the Japan disaster and using more of that, you know, wind and solar power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they get it. Why don't we get, what is wrong with our country? My goodness. And we're going backwards. Talk about dark ages between women's reproductive rights in this country and climate reality. It's a sad commentary, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. There is a Neanderthal quality of American politics. I don't know exactly how to fully explain it other than we have, you know, I'm not sure that it's totally cultural, but I'm sure that it's partially cultural. There's a kind of closet frontiers anarchism in American mentality. I think it goes beyond that. I think what sustains that is the way we run our political system.
I agree. And, you know, we're laughing, but it's not funny at all, of course. And, DR, any closing comments about your fellow Republicans? I know you don't relate to them at all, but just take us behind their thinking. What has gotten them to stoop this low?
Well, there is no real thinking to it. It's sort of like, my theory on what's going on now, both with the climate denial and sort of the reproductive denial, is that this is an attempt to sort of turn out the final batch of Christian right voters and the final batch of socially conservative voters. And basically, once those voters are no longer around, what are they going to do? I say they'll have to bring the Rockefeller Republicans back, but, you know, that's going to take a lot of time and a lot of money and a lot of effort, and what is going to be the forcing that compels them to wake up and realize that they have to deal with the problems of today and the problems of tomorrow, not the problems of yesterday?
Yeah.
Well put. Any final thoughts, Dr. Jenkins?
No, good luck.
To all of us. Thank you so much. That is Dr. Craig Jenkins, and he is a sociology professor at Ohio State. He was one of the lead authors on this very important work, also done by Dr. Robert Brule, who wanted to be on the show, but he was away for the last couple of weeks, so he recommended Dr. Jenkins. I'm really glad we got him on just to talk about this research showing there's a connection between, among other things, what politicians say and how much media coverage there is of climate change and the level of concern on the part of Americans. So I'm sure, DR, you'd agree with me that among the takeaways here is that there is a need for a program on a regular basis, on a robust mainstream platform that talks about the reality of climate change and other environmental challenges that are oh so urgent.
Absolutely.
Thanks for joining me, DR. I really appreciate your joining me for that segment. I know this is our favorite subject, and I always like to have a resident Republican on with me to just make sure I don't get too biased here. But I think on green issues, what I say, we're red and blue, black and white, but green all over. When we come back, we'll be talking about how you can reduce your ecological footprint by reducing your energy output. Be right back.
Seems the more lies they told, the more money they got. They got Nobel Prizes.